and light showers and possible thunderstorms throughout the day today. Our high heading for 73. Tonight, careful, flash flood watch in effect through Saturday morning. More rain and thunderstorms overnight, a low of 58. Saturday, cloudy, slight chance of rain for Saturday morning. Then it turns, sunny and mild for Saturday afternoon, a high of 68. Sunday, sunny and 70. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Well, once in a while, we delve into the world of sports, of competitive athletics, and we're going to do that big time over the next few minutes in talking about an interesting book called The Anatomy of Competition in Sports, The Struggle for Success in Major U.S. Professional Leagues. In this really interesting book, the author, Christopher Doob, examines what life is like in the arenas of various major league enterprises. For instance, Major League Baseball, the National Football League, the National Basketball Association, the National Hockey League, and so on. And it is a most intriguing look at what life is like in the upper echelons of these particular team sports in particular, and the kind of stresses and challenges which these elite athletes face, the kind of incredibly tough struggle it is to reach the pinnacle of their various sports, and how precarious that place at the top can be. And of course, the reality is that the vast majority of athletes who pursue such success never do attain it, never do reach the upper ranks of their respective sports. And yet, so often they are driven all the same towards that ever more elusive pursuit. All of this is examined by Christopher Doob, who's been a professor of sociology at Southern Connecticut State University. And he has examined a number of different important issues, including race relations and social inequality. Perhaps you have seen his previous book, Racism: An American Cauldron, and other books which he has written. He also has had all of his life a very passionate love of sports and been an athlete himself. So he brings some of that personal perspective as well to the topic. The title again is The Anatomy of Competition in Sports, The Struggle for Success in Major U.S. Professional Leagues, published by Roman and Littlefield. Professor Christopher B. Doob, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
So tell us, first of all, your own relationship with sports. You kind of vague reference to it in your own biography, that it's been some kind of important part of your life. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay, sure. In the preface, it's indicated that when I was a little kid, 4 or 5 years old, I had another kid living close by who was really a kind of master of competition. He was a pretty good athlete, but he was very, very good at defeating his opponents, much better than I was. I think I learned to compete fairly effectively when I was about 18 or 19. But this guy could do it from age 4 or 5 on. And I resented it terrifically. But I also admired him and was intrigued. And so that idea of competition and interest in it started at a very young age. I played, well, there are 5 sports there and 6 leagues because of the women's the WNBA. I played all of them except hockey. I can't stand up on skates. And I was most proficient at soccer. I played college soccer. I was fairly good. I actually began to master that competition thing. So, and I've loved sports all my life.
So you remain a fan. I mean, you're perfectly happy up in the stands. Do you find that as you have watched and followed hockey over the years, have you been wearing your sociologist's cap as you viewed sports? Or is this a fairly recent or kind of a concerted effort on your part to look at sports through the lens of your own academic discipline?
Oh, that's very interesting. I imagine to some degree I've always brought the sociology in. For instance, in the hockey chapter at the end, there's this discussion of the fact that in hockey, unlike any other sport I know, there's this idea of a chosen one. It's Sidney Crosby at the moment. Probably he's about to give it up. And that sort of fits in with the sociological sense of charismatic, that these guys are really sort of charismatic leaders who are not only, they have to be great players, but they also are kind of moral leaders in hockey at the same time. And that's very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I raise, and I think I know the answer, but I don't for sure, is whether or not one of these guys, and there have been about 6 of them going back to the 1960s, whether one of these guys could be anything but a Canadian. They've all been Canadian.
Ah, interesting.
And the game is, first and foremost, a Canadian game, even if the Canadians over time have a declining percentage of players. They still have 50%.
And I think you're suggesting that in some cases some of the climate of hockey still reflects its Canadian roots.
I would really think so, yeah. They had a good deal going in the beginning because I think they had a major role in controlling the game. Because one of the things that they had was what was called the 50-mile rule, a radius of 50 miles around where the team was located. The players were more or less automatically members of that club, or were, you know, at least candidates to be members. So imagine the difference with Toronto and Montreal versus, let's say, New York City back in the 40s or 30s. You know, what's the chances that you're going to get a really good player from Hoboken? I mean, it's just not going to happen. So there was a kind of stranglehold, I think, in the beginning by the Canadian contingents, especially those 2 teams on hockey, and it's somewhat less. I think that's evidenced by the fact, for me at least, that there's relatively few teams in Canada. There are a bunch of sort of middle-sized cities, like Saskatoon or Hamilton or something like that, that could undoubtedly support a team. But the administration hasn't, in hockey, has not supported that.
The examination that you have of these major sports is especially valuable when we look at it through a special frame of what you call 4 pro players' uncommon experiences. That is, there are four common traits to all of these major professional team sports, and this sets them apart from more typical occupations and professional pursuits which the rest of us might pursue. And I think this was really, really valuable because it really helped me look at the experience of athletes through different eyes. And I think we should touch on each of them. And the first, I think, is especially crucial, and I'd never stop to think about it.
Uh-huh.
That is sort of the long incubation. Successful athletes, you write, have a sustained exposure to their future occupational activity, often as children, playing the game many hours a day and in the process building skills which eventually become sufficiently refined that they qualify as professionals. That notion of repeated exposure and experience and immersion over a long, long period of time, that is in stark contrast to almost anybody else in almost any other kind of profession. And what do you see as the most important significance of that?
Well, I think it's what you're saying, that, you know, starting often, and it was true for me, I just happened not to be that good, but I started around 4 playing baseball and football, and many, many other kids do too. And a surgeon, as you're saying, a surgeon gets no childhood experience or an accountant or whatever that builds their career. They possibly might, but the odds are they won't. But in sports, it happens all the time. And so these kids start in, especially these days. In fact, I'm writing about this now elsewhere. It's become that childhood experience has become more organized. There's more and more sports for not only little boys, but little girls, too, in sports like hockey and lacrosse. And, you know, they get tremendous amount of coaching. And, of course, the thing to point out here, Greg, also is that sometimes it's a very difficult proposition. The parents can be very, very freaky. They can get very involved in this and push their children terribly hard. And yet, to go back to your original point, this is different. It's one of four experiences. What I wanted to show was that eventual professional athletes share these four experiences. This is the first. Oh, by the way, I should say one other thing. These are sequential. The first one starts in childhood. The second one is sort of the gateway to pro sports. The third is being in pro sports. And the fourth is leaving it.
Right. That second one is really the matter of math. You say the numbers game is eye-opening, and only the tiniest percentage of individuals are able to play professionally. And when we look at those numbers, it's sort of staggering that anybody ever seriously pursues it. And yet, if people are immersed sometimes from an extremely early age and come to be so devoted to the sport or sports they're playing, it's little wonder that many people find themselves just chasing after this dream, even though it is almost without exception a preposterous dream to chase.
That's right. Again, in the material I'm looking at now, one psychologist who's advising parents says, tell your children they're not going to make it to the professional leagues. You know, the odds are, obviously he's going to be wrong once in a while, but almost always he'll be correct. Yeah, it's just it's a very, very long shot. Right. One of the things that is kind of tantalizing about this, you talk about those tiny numbers of 1 in 1,000 or whatever. that certain individuals, and I read a book about minor league baseball, and there's a quote in the chapter on baseball. Some of the players are right on the cusp. You know, they're right, almost good enough to make it to the majors. Too good for, let's say, in baseball, AAA. They actually, I didn't know this until I read the book. They have a name for that. They call it 4A. Of course, there is no 4A. It's a AAA or 3A. But they're the level up from that, but not good enough. And these guys can go through a really painful experience because they'll get called up and then sent down. And there was an interview in the book about one guy who'd been called up 12 times to the majors and then sent down. So, you know, there are all sorts of stories here.
Absolutely. And, of course, the third point, which is also so important, is that what you just described and everything else that an athlete does plays out in what you describe as a highly exposed public setting where fans have ample chance to see them either succeed or fail, often responding vocally or approaching them after games. I mean, all of this, for good and for ill, plays out in a public arena. And so that just adds to the intensity of the experience, the intensity of the thrills, and the intensity of all of the disappointments that are also part of any pro athlete's experience.
I'm really glad you bring these four points out there because they really are interesting and they're important and they show the kind of kinship that exists from one sport to another because all these guys go through these same general experiences. I was listening or watching, I'm sorry, a baseball game the other day with the Tigers, and Justin Verlander was being interviewed after the game, and he said, wow, he pitched a really good game, but he came fairly close to a no-hitter. And he said, wow, it really helped me to have the fans cheering for me. And that's, as you say, the positive side. The negative side is all sorts of issues. And I was just able to sort of slip this stuff in because it happened shortly before I had to finish the book. But and that's the issue of the fact that their athletes are more exposed now in the media to journalists. It's much of it's very, very good. You know, Adrian Peterson or a Ray Rice. I think for me, particularly Ray Rice doing what he did 10 years ago, what do you think? I don't think that would have come to public attention. Huge attention and huge repercussions for Ray Rice.
Of course. There is also, of course, it's something which has been talked about quite a lot, particularly when it comes to things like concussions in pro football.
Yes.
Namely, the devastating physical toll that is taken on the body, particularly in football, but certainly in some of these other sports as well. And that is just one element, which is, of course, a much more harsh reality than it is in many other professions. But on top of it, then, you have the whole notion of a coach or a manager deciding so-and-so stays, so-and-so goes, he's not contributing enough, she's a disruption or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there are all these different factors which are present which can end one's career or curtail one's success in some ways that are fairly unique compared to the vast majority of professions out there.
That's right. If you're teaching fifth grade in the course of your work, you're not very likely to get a concussion. I mean, you just won't get these kind of injuries. It's interesting what's going on in big-time sports now because these guys, meaning the officials, Roger Goodell and others, they're forced to look at this kind of stuff much more than they really want to. There's just huge pressure on them. And, you know, I was listening to you, and you mentioned football. I've got some data in there from Mel Kiper Jr. about the size of offensive players, the linemen. They're so much bigger than they used to be. So their possibilities of creating injury are much greater. They're also faster, stronger. It's pretty scary stuff. But the other thing I wanted to say is hockey. You know, there's some material in there about concussions in hockey. And hockey has an issue that the other sports don't have. I give Canada, again, some of the credit for this, this sort of cultural approach. But they strongly support, I've got some data in there, that indicates that the players strongly support the idea of enforcers. Having a guy on your team who defends, physically defends his teammates against the opponents. And they claim, the players, that this doesn't create a lot of concussions. I really wonder. I'm sure we'll get more on this in the years to come. They're going to be interesting.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Christopher B. Doob, the author of The Anatomy of Competition in Sports, The Struggle for Success in Major U.S. Professional Leagues. Just a couple of questions to kind of illuminate the detail with which you approach this. In the chapter devoted to Major League Baseball, the opening chapter of the book, one of the things you lay out for us is this intriguing system of the minor leagues. If I remember off the top of my head, a five-level system, actually, which is really not duplicated in any of the other sports that
not
you
even
not
close.
Right.
No.
What do you think it is about the sport of baseball that has led to the emergence of this extensive and intricate minor league system?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I've got much of an answer. I thought about it quite a bit. I didn't look into it because it's probably not something I should be developing. But there's no question. What you've got in baseball each year is 40 rounds of drafting. You know what you have in the NBA? You have two. It's amazing.
Right.
Then those are the extremes. This system has developed, I think, since the 20s and 30s. I don't know too much about it. Branch Rickey, who, of course, is famous for his project of bringing up Jackie Robinson into the major leagues, helped to develop them. I don't believe they existed before that. I think at that time, there was a greater general affluence, especially among owners. What I keep wondering, Greg, is how these minor league owners can afford to have these teams. And the turnout is very slight, very small numbers. So I don't really have an answer to that. I'm not sure there's an easy one.
Right.
I have the feeling, to just tell you one more thing, I have a feeling from watching Double-A baseball in New Haven that there's this sort of cachet value of being an owner. There was a Yale graduate who was quite successful in business, and he bought the Double-A team in New Haven or West Haven a number of years back. And maybe that's how it works all through the minors. I don't know.
When you also when you talk about baseball, one of the things that, of course, adds to the great stress that its athletes experience is the fact that although it is, in one sense, very much a team sport, it's also a very individual sport with very clean, clear individual statistics, which make every play that an individual player does not only important, but also very quantifiable. and so you sort of live and die by things like your batting average and other statistics, and, you know, including errors and home runs and so on. And the numbers can go into bewildering tailspins. And I really appreciate how you kind of help us understand how that reality in the game of baseball, particularly played at that level, is can be really a daunting mental and emotional load for a given athlete.
Absolutely, I put that beautifully. I'm grateful to one of my sources who pointed this out, and I thought, wow, that's a really good distinction. He was talking about baseball versus football. Have you ever seen a statistic for an offensive lineman? I never have.
Right.
They're working as a unit. Their contribution is very important. But in baseball, the hitters and the pitchers are highly individualized. The other thing also that this guy pointed out is they're physically separated much more than in most other sports. If you're a pitcher, you are alone out there on the mound. And I've got a quote from a minor league player who talks about his struggles and collapsing in front of the top brass in a game where he so badly wanted to do well and there was no place to hide.
When you get to the game of professional football, you make an observation that I don't remember hearing before, although maybe I've just missed it in other books, but I want you to talk about this.
Sure.
You say, unlike baseball, which generally features individual achievements, football reflects the industrial era in which it developed, a series of collective acts involving a set of teammates who function like the coordinated parts of a smoothly running machine. I mean, I've thought about that last part, but I've never connected it to the industrial era in which the game of football was conceived and created.
Yes. Yes, that's right. It's actually a local guy here in Connecticut who had as much to do with the development and was very kind of industrially oriented. His day job involved being the president of a clock company. His name is Walter Camp. And Walter Camp developed rules that I think very much incorporated that idea. The other thing Walter Camp was trying to, or one of the other things he was trying to do, was, along with Teddy Roosevelt and others, save the game because it was so horribly violent at that time.
Exactly. Well, and that connection to the industrial era and this idea of the team being a machine with different components, in a sense, helps explain why, first of all, it might appear to be, and perhaps to some extent, in fact, is a game in which players are treated like interchangeable parts. And
that's
when
right.
one wears out, you throw it away and you stick another person in there, except that person is a part as far as the controllers of the game are concerned. You also mentioned in this chapter that the average stay in the NFL is 3.5 years.
Incredible,
I think most people would be so surprised to hear that, especially, for instance, here in Wisconsin, where, you know, we appreciate the durability of somebody like a Brett Favre.
Oh, he's marvelous.
Yeah, but that is not the typical story of the typical NFL player.
No, it's not. If I can just add one thing to the previous issue, the numbers that players have in football reflect the position that they have. So that sort of fits in with that idea of units or subunits. It's a tough sport. Hard to get there, and the injuries are widespread in football. People don't keep up the performance level that's necessary. All sorts of difficulties can occur. Run-ins with the law or other personal difficulties. So players players just simply don't last very long, and they don't last a whole lot longer in baseball or basketball. It's about 5 years. But the 3.5, I agree with you. It's startling.
Yeah, it really is. Could we just say a quick word about the place of integration in your book? I was actually a little bit surprised, but I'm glad that you spent as much time as you did talking about the fairly slow rate at which integration occurred in Major League Baseball, professional football, and professional basketball. Why did you think, in kind of talking about the competitive rigors of these different sports, that integration was such a crucial thing to give so much attention to?
Well, if you're a Bill Russell, who just made it into the draftable era, say you come along 5 years earlier, you have marvelous skills, but your ability to compete is probably zilch, because they just won't take you. They were just starting at that time to appreciate African-American basketball players. And it's true also in baseball. With Jackie Robinson coming along, there were a few that began to trickle in after 47. I think one in the American League that same year. But it was a very small number for quite some time. Now, one of the things that's interesting, and for somebody who's always been involved with race, somewhat disheartening, is the fact that now, in baseball in particular, it's not true in the other sports, although there's interesting nuance with basketball, now the number of black baseball players has sharply declined. It's not because they're discriminated against directly. It's because of income relation and black families not able to afford to send their kids to college as much. There are relatively few baseball scholarships, and they get broken up so that a kid, black or white, is not going to get much support. And also because, with limited funding, they're less able to send them on the trips that developing basketball players play after Little League. I could say something, if you wish, about basketball.
Yeah, I think you should.
Yeah. This was kind of startling to me. I didn't know this. I always thought of basketball as an inner city game, black or white, but particularly black. And what I learned from two studies that are cited in the basketball chapter is that now an increasing percentage of black players in the NBA are middle class. And it's because of the fact that they go to schools that have very good facilities and very good coaches, or relatively good coaches. And it gives them a huge advantage over inner city kids who have access to less quality supports.
Hmm. That really flies into the face of a lot of assumptions we make.
Yeah.
Particularly when somebody like a LeBron James comes along from very modest background.
That's right.
And we sort of tend to spread his relatively uncommon experience across a wider swath of the NBA, when in fact he is a relatively rare case.
That's right. It's true. Mm. Yeah. He's interesting. He's an exception in several ways. As you say, the income issue. The point for him, or another point for him, and for some of the other inner-city guys who've made it, is LeBron had terrific support from his mother. And I quoted LeBron in there on the importance of his mother. And then, of course, the obvious one is talent. But those three factors made him unusual. You're right. Mm. There aren't too many guys like that.
We should make mention, although we have just a moment or two left, to say that you do take some time in your book to talk about professional women's basketball.
Absolutely.
Now, some people actually might be surprised that that they have a place beside behemoths like the NBA and the NHL and so on. But clearly you thought that they were a worthwhile organization to include in your book. Why?
Yes. Well, it's not only the WNBA, it's also Major League Soccer, which is not doing real well either economically. What I think was the determinant here, because you're quite right, you've got four sports, including hockey, that are really quite successful economically, and then you got two others, WNBA and National Hockey League, that aren't. But I wanted to include, I'm a great believer in survival, and both of these leagues are close to 20 years old. They've been around. Lord knows they struggle. I had the feeling with the WNBA, I think it was about a year and a half ago, when the Los Angeles Sparks was sold by an owner that they couldn't afford to lose $1 million a year. That sounds like a lot of money, but for, you know, the Steinbrenner family or someone like that, it's nothing. But I was thinking, Magic Johnson and his L.A. Dodgers co-owners hadn't come along and bought the team, it might have been the end of the league. Mm-hmm. So I must say, Greg, I haven't been entirely comfortable with this, but I think my feeling is I'm giving credit where it's very much due.
Mm-hmm.
And also, well, I guess one other thing to say, for both MLS and especially the WNBA, is they got marvelous players, many of them. They're really good. They're every bit as competitive as any of the other leagues.
Well, it's a fascinating book, start to finish, and I am so glad that we had the chance to kind of explore it. And we leave it to our listeners to take it in hand and explore it still further. The title of the book is The Anatomy of Competition in Sports, The Struggle for Success in Major U.S. Professional Leagues, published by Roman and Littlefield. And the author, Professor Christopher Doob. And the time is 8:47, and we're finishing out today's Music Potpourri by hearing from Tony Nathan, a high school, college, and NFL football star who has gone on to coach with great distinction as well, and has written a memoir about his life in football called Touchdown Tony, Running with a Purpose, The Making of a Man and the Healing of a City. Tony Nathan's book is published by Howard Books. In it, among other things, he describes his relatively late beginning in playing organized football. A late beginning which had a little bit to do with his own mother's reluctance and conflicted relationship with the game.
Well, organized football, I guess you consider it being late, because we had to name the neighborhood. We used to get together as kids and play all the time. And it just wasn't organized the way it is. We drew it up in the dirt, and the way it was when I went to Woodlawn. But once I got to Woodlawn, all my friends was playing. You know, a couple other people that I knew was there was going out for them, you know, the B team, freshman team. And I had a chance to do so at that point in time. And when my sophomore year rolled around, some of them was deciding that they didn't want to play, and other ones was told they couldn't play, and they was at home, and I was at practice, and I was like, wait a minute. Something ain't right with this pitcher. So I left and went home. And when I walked in the door, I guess me or my high school coach had called my mom and asked her where I was. I wasn't at practice. And not knowing they had communicated before I got there, she asked me, well, what? Why are you here? Why aren't you at practice? I said, well, you know, nobody's there, so I decided to come home. She said, I've never known a Nathan to quit, and you're not going to be the first. So get in the car and let's go. So she took me back to practice and told the coach to do what he had to do. But put him as far away from the football as you possibly could. So she really didn't want me to play. And she kind of like my high school coach said, well, you coached him that year. In my junior year, he said, I'm coaching him from now on. So that's when I got moved to running back.
You said that you always liked to tackle more than to be tackled. And that was part of the reason why you also, it was okay with you if other people were given the ball more than you did. But you you had a real gift as a running back, didn't you?
It came natural. It definitely came natural. I guess he got an idea because when we were playing games, you know, and people would actually try to throw me in. Anytime they threw the ball and I thought I could get it, I would go intercept it. And he realized that I actually could run with the ball after I got it in my hands. And my mom was saying, no, are you here saying, no, no, no? So I was like, oh, Lord. But then on my junior year, he decided to move me over to running back.
And the rest is history, at least as far as Woodlawn High School is concerned. One of the things you talk about in your book is how you were one of relatively few, a very few black football players on your high school team, and one of relatively few black students in your high school. And yet you managed to navigate that kind of challenging situation very, very well. What were the attitudes that guided the way you sort of conducted yourself at that particular high school and as part of that team so predominantly made up of white students?
Well, myself being raised where I was by my parents, they didn't see color. They judged people by the character that what they showed them, and whether or not they were good people or not, they let them make that decision. And I watched my father, listened to my father, and my grandfather also was a great example for me. And but when I got to high school, once Coach Gerald found out that I was some sort of, I guess, decent athlete, during that time when we started actually playing ball in my freshman and sophomore year, he would act as my father away from home, and he stayed around the door. Whenever I had to pass class, he would come up and get me and walk me where I had to go just to make sure I didn't follow the wrong crowd or fall, you know, do something I didn't have no business doing. He actually spent the time, and I really do appreciate him. You know, I had great men to tutor me as I grew up, so it was a gift from God that these people showed the interest in me and to show me what I needed to do and not let me react to what was going on around me.
One of the things you say in the book is that you learned a lot at Woodlawn High, but you learned more about people than you did about your school subjects. What are the most important things you learned about people in those years?
Well, I mean, people are not all bad, and sometimes you're a product of your environment. You're doing what you see other people are doing, and you're acting because or you want to fit in with the crowd that you're hanging with. I noticed, I guess you would say I'm a little bit mature for my age, and I noticed that when I was in the neighborhood, that was what I did. And Coach Gerald helped me see and realize that, so I just started taking people for who they were and not, you know, what they were showing me, what they was doing. And it was giving people an opportunity to show me whether or not I should spend the time to talk with them or be around them or not.
Hmm. One of the really touching moments in the book is when you are moved to running back on your high school team, that some of the white players evidently resented that place of prominence given to you, not all your teammates, but a few of them. And it was actually one of your white teammates named Mike Allison who ended up making a really big difference in some of those other teammates accepting you. Tell us what Mike Allison did and the difference it made.
Well, he stood up and he actually, told everybody, said, look, this is a team. We're here together. We're going to play together, or we're going to make it together, or we're going to die together. And we are here not as separate people. We are here as one, as a team. And I truly to this day respect the man. He's a detective now in Birmingham, and I really do appreciate it. That showed me that not all people are bad. And I respect him. And then another guy, Peyton, he followed suit, and pretty soon some other guy decided, you know, it was the right thing to do. And, you know, I can't say what the guy was actually thinking that actually spoke in a negative sense, because I was actually taking his place, you know, but the way he came off, the way he said it, I do not hold no grudge for it toward him. But, you know, it's just one of those things. He reacted to what happened to him. So that's why I say it's not what you do with what happened to you. It's how you react to what happens to you. So, and it went from there. And then after that, it was a different story.
We're speaking with Tony Nathan and talking about his experiences on the football team as a high school football star, as a college football star, eventually as a star in the NFL, and then a highly regarded coach as well. Your next step was to the University of Alabama, where you got to play for the legendary coach Bear Bryant. And this was also a situation in which the number of African-American players was certainly much more limited than it is now. And but by and large, it sounds like you had a tremendously successful and happy time there playing at Alabama and playing for Coach Bryant. What are your most vivid memories of Coach Bryant and the way in which he led you and your teammates?
Well, I mean, he was the type of guy. He was a nonsense type of guy, and he wasn't going to tolerate people acting crazy or saying things or doing things that he didn't want a part of being a part of his team. Even he got on me a couple of times. Well, I know he got on me my freshman year about because I scored and I did my little dance in the end zone because I was happy there and whatnot, came to the sideline. He called me over to him and said, "Son, look, we have no lightning bugs on the ball club." And first, I've had to think about it. Then I'm like, okay, you can't show your behind. Then, you know, so he told me, get a ball to the fisher and act like you've been in the end zone before. And I was like, cool, okay, no problem. So he taught me humility and to respect other people, because you kind of, you know, when you do your little dance, you kind of, you know, showing up to other team and whatnot. So he just said, respect your opponent.
Among the interesting experiences you had, I mean, you say repeatedly that your family largely shielded you from some of the racial unrest of that era, and that for the most part you never really thought of yourself as a civil rights activist in any kind of way. But you look back now and realize that you made a positive difference in the situations just by the way you carried yourself and played with such integrity. There was a moment, though, during your time at Alabama when you ended up taking a stand, and it involved a visit to Alabama by George Wallace. Tell our listeners what happened on that occasion and the decision which you made.
Well, man, he was one of the individuals that I saw on TV making a statement that there will not be integration, never will be integration. And at the time, he said colors would never go to school here. And I understand the wind does change directions. People do change along the way. And I would say at that point in time when he came down him to take the picture and ask the captain to take the picture, I just didn't find it in my heart to do so. I just told Coach Bryant, I said, "Coach, I refuse to do it. I can't do it." He told him I couldn't come to school here. It's just that something I'm not going to do it. And Coach Bryant respected my wishes.
Football player Tony Nathan And his book, his memoir about his career in football is called Touchdown Tony, Running with a Purpose, The Making of a Man and the Healing of a City. Monday on the morning show, you'll hear my conversation with Mary Flum Peterson. She is a producer for Good Morning America. Her memoir about life with her mother is called White Dress, as a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad.